Alright, time once again for another DoNotGod.com video presentation. Alright, so what's all this about? Yeah, we're sort of down to that. Why bother? Why bother talking, making video, whatever this is? And the whole point is because there's a truth in the world. And the truth applies to us also. And I'm arguing, okay, that most of the things that are true in the world have been under-defined or described wrong. You know, I mean, half-truths all over the place, part of the right answer. You know, I could just point to, like, you know, a gorilla. And, you know, people say, oh, it's a chimpanzee. You know, they'll do something, okay, where somehow they have to mess it up. So no matter what it is that we're talking about, there'll be somebody who has some opinion that is completely different. And that really, technically, shouldn't happen. We shouldn't have that problem. Because, frankly, we're all raised here on the same earth, and you know, some things are so consistent: grass, trees, you know, asphalt, cement, whatever. It's not diverse enough environment for us to be shaped different, for there to be, you know, western box turtles and eastern box turtles and all that kind of crap. We shouldn't be very different because the environment's so much the same. And especially the environment that anybody who, you know, has read a book or two exists in. Those are all foundational, you know. Even if it's Dr. Seuss, I mean, doesn't, you know, lots of common references. But no common understanding. So, you know, people can look at this and somebody sees, oh, isn't that cute? yummy, yummy, or something, you know. You're just like, yeah, that's really not what's happening, you know. Seeing the bigger picture of the whole predator-prey arrangement created by evolution, you know, making monsters. I mean, these are real, you know, so, I mean, yes, I've made a ton of videos explaining how what I think the more accurate description is. And, you know, there's just lots of things to describe. There's lots of things to point out and say, what does it mean? What is it? What does it represent? Is it the, you know, the best we could do? So what I was thinking about was the, you know, the artificial intelligence has been in the news lately, so to speak. At least the news I hear. Other stuff is probably more important. But anyway, just as a subject. And so it got me thinking about, you know, the artificial intelligence is just an intelligence separated from what we are bound by, which is all of our feelings. And obviously our feelings create all these biases, you know, because we like some food and we don't like other food, and we like some smells and we don't like other smells, and all of that crap completely distorts, you know, any hope of the part of us that's AI, you know, the part that's just supposed to be doing logic, you know, adding up all the facts and then drawing the equation, you know, simplifying it and making a statement about, well, what does it represent or what is it? So if we were just evaluating fairly, you know, trains versus planes versus trucks, you know, as a way of transporting stuff, let's say, there would be some diagram, some drawing we could make that would say, well, this is the most efficient way to get stuff from point A to point B. And, you know, you could consider all kinds of environmental issues and, you know, all the superfluous, you know, expenses, like, you know, how much it tears up the roads or this or that or some other thing. And there would be an answer to the question that would actually be right, you know, and there'd be a lot of other wrong answers. But, you know, there'd be one right calculation that said, yeah, that's the way it adds up. And but we can't do any of that because we're all, you know, you grew up next to the train tracks and you have all kinds of fond feelings for trains. You don't want trains to lose the competition. You know, or your daddy was a truck driver or some other bullshit. You know, and you see this all the time, you know, somebody whose grandfather was a cop and he revered him, you know, so he just can't quite see that, oh, you mean these are just brutes, you know, people who like playing the tough guy, you know, they're just bullies who get to take their bulliness into adulthood, you know, or some other psychology. Now, that might not have been fair, frankly. That's not a complete description of coppery. I mean, I'm committing, you know, one of the errors of humans is this idea that, you know, we do things quickly. Well, we try to do them quickly. We're really slow. And it, you know, so we try to be fast, and the fast answers aren't very good answers. Something wrong with the voice. I have to fix that. So any opportunity to take a pause, you know, then stuff pops into the head. And so I was just noticing how, you know, there's routines and habits, you know. And so part of the problem is I make these videos in the morning. It's probably not the best time to make a video. So I haven't, like, optimized the time I make the video for good reasons. It's all just optimized for the fact that you have to live a life and do all this other crap, and you can't waste the daylight hours, you know, making videos, that kind of thing. So you get into a habit that, you know, blends your subjective needs, or you could say, or your competing needs, and, you know, it makes other things less than optimum. So it's all these compromises, you know, all these corners cut to placate the fact that we have to do lots of, we have to multitask. And so none of the tasks get done right. All of them are marginalized by the fact that we have lots of other things we have to do, and, you know, that gets in the way. All right, so back to the theme subject, which is, you know, what if we were artificial intelligences in the sense that we didn't have feelings, you know, so we had no personal interest. There wasn't any idea of, I'm going to have a bad day or a good day. I'm going to have good feelings or bad feelings. You know, then our intelligence would be liberated in this, you know, from all of that subjective feeling stuff, all those passions about the people you admire, the, you know, the sports heroes or some other kind of crap that keeps you glued to some sort of story that seems familiar and fun. You know, it was always done that way, and you like it that way, and you have a habit that says, you know, that's the right way to cook it, kind of thing. You know, your mother cooked a certain way, and you want your food a certain way, and you don't like change much, and all of that kind of crap. So all that gets in our way of making any kind of judgments about the value of things. All right. So, you know, just understanding how much our psychology pollutes our judgment, you know, it's one of the big ones. You know, it's a huge thing to appreciate as a fact, your own corruption, the corruption of all these, you know, that intuitive first impressionist, you know, what is it, how does it make me feel, comfortable or uncomfortable? Does something rub me the right way or the wrong way? And all of that is what more or less controls everything rather than any thoughtful process of thinking about implications and what's in the long-term best interest and all of that kind of stuff. Most of what we do ends up being some short-term, immediate gratification kind of thing. So that's another concept that, you know, that's certainly been talked about a lot in psychology discussions, is impulsiveness, you know, and the difference between, you know, thinking about the long-term consequences of an act versus the short-term gratification. I mean, that's something people should always be aware of. You know, are they making a decision based on, you know, how they immediately feel, or how, or what's in their long-term best interest? And you could say this is how people get overweight and lots of things that blight their life are, you know, where they made a few of these impulsive in the short-term interest decisions that, you know, really had a, you know, for the rest of your life implication. And, you know, this is one of those things, you know, if you're going to give a self-help, this would be some of the crap you might spew. Now, I'm arguing it in the broad, bigger sense that philosophers should be aware of all this kind of crap if they're going to talk about what it means, you know, what it is to be alive and what your responsibilities are and all that kind of crap. They have to be just as aware of all of that psychobabble crapola that's controlling what they're saying. And they have to be really careful that what they're making is a real argument and not some argument from tradition. yeah. So that's the other context of this. So, in that context, I'll do a little dream analysis. So I'm always thinking about these subjects, and I suppose I think more now, well, I really don't, about, you know, the difficulty in communicating the ideas more than thinking about the actual ideas. Like, you don't have to construct a logical foundation for a theory of the truth, and then just put it out there and say, see, it's logical, it fits, it works. You have to fight through a bunch of people's obnoxious and subjective and personal dislike of the truth, or dislike of change, dislike of anything that might say they've poorly used their time, or they've lived a stupid life, or they've been cruel, or, you know, if there's some sort of statement in there. Somebody commented on a video where they made some idiotic comment about how plants might feel. Now, the only reason why they're doing it is to justify eating meat. So they're making up this irrational kind of notion that why would anybody even think plants are conscious? I mean, why would they even imagine it as being possible? For what purpose, except to make some sort of justification for some sort of action. And then it was so illogical. So it's really bizarre, even, for somebody to speculate about thinking consciousness doesn't need a brain, it doesn't need neurons, you know, I mean, all of that doesn't have to exist. I mean, that's already being silly. I mean, you might as well talk about cars being conscious or something. You know, I mean, I certainly have more neuron-like electronics than a frickin' plant. But, you know, the real dumb part is that, you know, the whole, it's not really a very effective against vegetarianism argument, because the whole point is you're currently feeding 70 times more vegetation to your animals before you eat them. So if you stop doing that, if you stop making cows and pigs and ducks and chickens and all that stuff, and instead ate what they're eating, you could do it like 70 times more efficiently and produce 70 times less plants that had to be murdered. So you'd be murdering 70 times less vegetation if you went vegetarian. And they don't even, you know. So, I mean, they're using a really dumb argument for really dumb reasons, and then they're, you know, they're doubling down on the dumb by it's not even a dumb argument, it's doubly dumb. And why? To preserve some notion that their life isn't bad and cruel, and that they're not being an asshole. You know, so it's just subjective crap. They want to take responsibility for poor habits and recognize that, yeah, it's just a fact. So, yeah, you're not as efficient as you could be. And they don't want to hear that. All right, so back to the dream thing, because, you know, my brain, you know, is playing with me. You know, when you go to sleep, your brain challenges you, okay, by trying to find your hypocrisies and duplicities and your bullshit and all that other kind of crap. It tests your notions of reality as practice. You know, it's throwing the things that disturb you at you, because those things obviously are important in your life because they disturb you. They can get to you. You're weak in those areas. And so I have a personal hypocrisy in the sense that you can't let go of attachment. So you got to say that even my attachment to my own stupid life, you know, and my idea that I like to finish it, you know, I like to you know, write the book and then sign it at the end, and, you know, I'd like to finish the process of doing whatever me is, and I just don't feel like it's finished. You know, and it's mostly because I don't have the plaque on the wall. You know, I don't have the certificate of, you know, you graduated. You know, and so it's like I just want to finish and get my certificate. That kind of feeling. And then the same thing comes up with stuff like, all right, so the dream was basically, okay, so there was a swimming pool and there was a little kitten at the bottom of the swimming pool, and there was clumps of leaves and other things that looked a little bit like the little kitten. For some reason, there was more than me there, and it was like, well, somebody should save the kitten. So everybody jumped in the pool to go save the kitten. But I kept picking up leaves. I couldn't find the kitten. So somebody else must have saved it. That was the assumption. Okay, this, because I couldn't find it. So then the dream did some other kind of bullshit. I don't know exactly what it was. And then I was feeling kind of guilty because I realized, hey, I never checked up on that kitten. You know, I never found out whether they who found the kitten. And so the guy who found the kitten was that guy who got killed by the stingray. You know, that the whatever. You know, the guy who used to irritate animals. You know, so he could film them. You know, it's all still drowned. I mean, it's all like a wet, dead kitten. And I said, well, you gotta do, you know, what do you do? What? You mean you just pulled it out of the water and you didn't do nothing? You just threw it on the, you know, the side of the pool? And so I'm like, fix it, you know, do something, pump the water out of it, you know, blah, 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 blah. And then as I'm doing that, my psychology is saying, wait a minute, you don't wake things up. That's a bad idea. Don't, it's dead. Leave it alone. And so the conflict started, but it was too late for me to have that self-conversation because the cat started to revive. And it was horrible because it was, you know, puking up all this water. It was terribly sick and scared and didn't understand what was going on. And so I felt really bad because, you know, it's got all this misery. And so I'm trying to, you know, pet it and make it feel better and trying to make it feel it's going to be okay. It'll be okay in a minute. It'll all get better, blah, blah, blah. And then somehow, you know, the cat's fear drove it up a, whatever, you know, bookcase or something. I don't even know what the hell it was. So I climb up after it. And then the mother cat shows up, right? So there's no mother cat. There's no, all of a sudden it just shows up. And she wants to get to her kitten, you know. So she's climbing up my leg to get to the kitten, and her claws are tearing my leg to pieces. And so I'm dangling, you know, trying to, you know, I got the kitten in one hand. I'm trying to hold on with another hand. I got a cat trying to climb up me like a tree. And fortunately, the dream ended around there. But it was just a very interesting metaphor of all of these conflicting arguments about, you know, that take place inside of me regarding you know, this instinct to help something, to make the bad go away, and doing it in the context of somehow being dead isn't what you want to be. And obviously I know being dead is what you want to be, but I just, you know, I can't get past that piece of psychology that says, well, nothing wants to be in that state. So, you know, part of my, I guess my reasoning is, when it's something else, it's okay. Where if it was me, it would be, why are you doing that? You know, why are you trying to force me to live and all this kind of crap? So it's just an interesting, it just shows that I do have, you know, the fact that it's a cat and it's not a, I don't know, a frog or some other animal that wouldn't invoke the same emotional reaction to protecting its welfare. All of that is, you know, in the psychology of the dream. But it just seemed to fit in the sense that I'm always trying to balance, you know, these different interests and, yeah, that's the struggle on the philosophical side, is how do you explain the fact that you can have this psychology, but you can know better. So it's sort of like making the argument where, you know, people really, you know, I piss some people off because I say, I don't care whether somebody's vegetarian. I just care that they don't pretend it's good to be a meat eater. So as long as they're willing to say, yeah, I have a really bad habit. I'd like to not be a meat eater, but, you know, I do eat it. I do like it. I do enjoy it. I need it psychologically, or even they could even argue they need it physically because they somehow don't feel very good if they eat other stuff, or if they don't have this meat in their diet. You know, they're addicted to the protein or whatever kind of argument they want to make. And the only thing that matters to me is that at least you acknowledge the truth, that if you were going to raise somebody or create a new human, you wouldn't make it a meat eater. You'd say, why wouldn't I just make it satisfiable without eating meat? That would be the logical thing to do. So as long as I'll concede the truth that it's not the best condition to be in, to be addicted or dependent on eating meat, then that's the only part of the argument that as a practical matter means much, because that's the future, and the future is so much bigger than the present, and it's also just a concession to the fact that we can't really change what we enjoy and what we don't. We can't, you know, I mean, so I can make this argument against football, and I guess I would just say to the footballers, you know, please don't give the addiction to somebody else. Don't defend your soap opera watching as anything more than soap opera watching, okay? That you're just addicted, okay? They told you a little bit of a story. It's a serial, you know, that comes on every week, Batman or something, and you want to see the, you know, the adventures, and you'll tune in next week to see what happens. You know, and just recognize it as a piece of psychological rubbish you have. And there'd be no point in giving that a taste of that heroin, you know, to your kids or to anyone else, or to celebrate at a bar or talk about how great it is or all that kind of, you know, keep it personal and private. You know, do your glorification of crap, okay, you know, where you should, out in the closet. Keep it in the closet. Your admiration and your whatever, you know. But don't defend it. Don't glorify it. Don't pretend, oh, this is good for humans and this makes us, you know, this makes us understand how to be cooperative and it doesn't, you know, what a pile of shit. You know, when you see all of the bad psychology that comes out of sports. I mean, all the dead wives. I mean, please. It's just so ridiculous. Too stupid, really. And so I could say the same about the Olympics and all these other things that are just insane waste of human resources. So you could make the same argument to the pet owners and say, you know, come on, you know, you don't see the perverse priorities here, and you know, these are just your little comfort animals, and they're just slaves to your emotional needs, and you know, it's don't pretend you're doing the animals a favor and all this other horse shit. You know, especially, you know, when you're subjecting them to, you know, your dependencies and shoving all kinds of crap up their ass to keep them alive much longer than they should be alive and all of that crap. It's just cruel and stupid. So I make those arguments in the context of the people who, you know, create these feral cat communities, you know, where they try, okay, to keep them, you know, reproductively incompetent, you know, which just isn't very practical. And what for? I mean, you know, you could go trap for the amount of money you have to spend to cut a cat's nuts off or to do surgery and, you know, remove ovaries and do all that crap. For the amount of money you have to spend on that, you could catch 10 cats. So, I mean, obviously you could get rid of you could really make a significant impact on the problem rather than wasting the money for the superficial, emotionally comforting notion that you're helping when, no, you're really just being cruel. I mean, you wouldn't want to live in a community, you know, you wouldn't want your nuts cut off and you're shoved in a community where you're half-fed. You have to fight with each other for territory and for a place to nap, and you know, and then people come up with some dopey idea that you should go out and eat rats, you know, so we have to keep you hungry enough so you'll go out and eat, you know, shit that might kill you. You know, you have to remain motivated, you know. That, you're not doing a cat a favor. So that's the, you know, so the job here is to keep talking through all of our human bullshit to get to the actual subjects. And the actual subject is that this is an addiction syndrome, being alive. You are now a book that has been opened, and it seems totally idiotic not to write something in it before you close it. It just doesn't make any sense to leave the paper blank or to start the story, you know, with, okay, there's a mountain and the sun rises and there's a little house and there's trees and there's a little babbling brook and blah, 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 and you describe all that crap and then you say, and now our character enters the room and then you close the book. No, that doesn't seem right either. And it's only, it doesn't seem right. It doesn't feel right. But it doesn't have anything to do with whether it is right. And the fact is, all the stories don't go anywhere. And they're all redundant. It's the same soap operas over and over and over. You just change Romeo and Juliet's name. You know, you change what kind of house they live in, what kind of pot they piss in. And, you know, same story, though. Over and over and over and over and over and over. For nothing. Because they all don't end very well. There's no great endings. You know, there's good and bad ways to die, but there's no great, you know, end to the story. It's all too little, too late, to whatever. It's just not good enough. Not nearly good enough. All right, take a pause. All right, so a few thoughts came to mind. And kind of competing, so I'll try to pick one. All right, so part of me just says, okay, look, I'm trying to argue where people sort of understand that what we're doing by being alive and all of this crap is robotic and redundant. You know, we're just byproducts of environments. We just go out and do the same basic crap, same formula, relived over and over. The same kind of civil wars, the same, you know, same players. It's all the same private, general, corporal bullshit. Hierarchies, same, just crap over and over and over. And it's not a good story. I mean, there's way too much, there's too many losers and too few winners. It's the Olympics argument. There's nothing to celebrate. There's so much agony of the defeat and so little glorious victory. And even when the people have the glorious victory, they end up defeated by their own inability to psychologically be fed by it, to be satisfied. Because it's not our nature to be satisfied, so we have to go out and do it again and again. And it's just, you know. All right, so that's the argument I'm attempting to make with people who are supposed to be life is precious and, you know, beautiful and all this crap. And so this sort of goes back to, you know, the fact that I've always sort of been a dissident and never felt part of the human community. It's always seemed an alien planet. I go back to just little things. You know, I would ponder as a little kid why my father had to dress in his uniform, you know, a suit, every day to go to work. And you're saying, why is that important? I mean, why can't he wear the same clothes he wears on the weekend? You know, why does he have to do this suiting up thing? What does the suit do for you? What does that have to do with doing anything? Because, you know, I figured he was doing something, fixing something, you know, doing something, and how would wearing a suit make you do it better? I mean, it just didn't make any sense. I couldn't make any sense out of it. You know, and then you learn why all these structures and these traditions exist in society, and it's like, yeah, none of them, I didn't feel like, oh yeah, this is just so natural. None of it felt natural to me. It all felt very alien and obnoxious to anything that would be comfortable and friendly and good. All right, so in that context, I want to get to the point I thought of, which is, yeah, so all these people are supposed to be very pro-life and very pro the human community and all this crap, and they don't seem to have any appreciation for all of these human stories. They're okay with people just being thrown in the ground, buried, the tombstone falls apart, and, you know, they eventually put a shopping mall on top of it. That there's all these lives lived, and we only know anything about a few little celebrity lives. And all the rest of the lives, all of those stories, the books are allowed to just rot in the rain. You know, they're just thrown, you know, they're just... Those books, nobody will read them, nobody will learn anything from them, nobody will be appreciating them. It just seems a waste of the story. It seems a waste of the experience, a waste of whatever was gleaned out of it. Yeah. So this was another thing I pondered as a kid, was just how little of this is recorded. You know, and that, you know, it seemed we had the capacity. So I'd say by the time I was a teenager, it really bothered me that, you know, there wasn't any recordings of Einstein or this or that. You know, there was nothing. All of this history that should have been recorded, and instead they had a bunch of crap recorded. They did have the Hindenburg blowing up, but when you viewed it, you could just see how much of reality wasn't recorded. It wasn't something you could appreciate or learn from or do any of that. So, you know, that bothered me. So there's all these people that are all pro-life, but they really don't have any respect for all the lives being lived, and creating any kind of record of the lives being lived. And so that sort of bleeds into this internet thing, where I find it kind of obnoxious, you know, that these trolls and other people can have these fake identities and be, you know, write complete fake narratives and all this, you know, all these, this fake life, fake news, fake shit. Because to me, it's a desecration of this idea that if anybody had any appreciation for the fact that every person is living a life, okay, you know, from a personal perspective that's quite rich, and if they're anything like me, yeah, they it seems important how they do and what happens to them and all of that. And we sort of appreciate that. I mean, we see, this is where it comes down to the cynical part. You know, we see people upset when a kid gets cancer or when a plane crashes or when some other thing happens to people. But maybe all they're upset about is that it's demonstrating a threat to them. I mean, if a plane can land on their house, a plane could land on my house. You know, if the flood could wash my kids away, you know, the flood could wash, I mean, their kids, it could wash my kids away. It's all about appreciating a threat to their story, not the fact that some other story was interrupted or destroyed. And so, yes, I tend to fall on that's the reason, okay, is that people don't genuinely have any respect for this living thing. They just have a great deal of love and appreciation for their own life. And they, you know, if you're going to pose the question of saying, well, is life in general worth it, they're going to answer the question based on what they think about their own life, not what they think about the concept of being alive, writing a story, and having the book rot in the, you know, out in the environment, how it turned into fertilizer, be forgotten, destroyed, eliminated, exterminated from any meaning or possibility of meaning to any future. The complete waste of life and the process of this experience thing and learning. So that brings to mind another, you know, where it gets generational and it gets a little strange, right? Because there's this idea that people gain some kind of wisdom with age. And some of that's true. You know, there's some greater perspective. But in so many cases, you know, there's just old people who learn to be perfect heroin addicts. They didn't learn anything about being an addict or, you know, being a robot, you know. So they don't really have anything to add. And then there's other old people who will, you know, tell you, don't even bother trying to breathe, because how you do it is you're gonna fuck it up. There's nothing you could do on this planet without, you know, taking huge risk, and it's all for naught. And so, yes, don't do anything. You know, keep it all to a gross minimum. You know, eat your yogurt and take a bath and a nap, and don't bother messing with anything, because it'll all turn to shit. Don't invest in anything, because it all breaks and degrades. I'm creating quite a cynical old man, but that's a real, you know, you'd say that, yes, generally speaking, old people have a kind of a curmudgeon view of things because of the fact that, yes, they've been burned enough times. They know, keep it simple, stupid, you could argue. They know, you know, those little simple, you know, don't take any wood nickels. But I just say they're just never philosophical enough to be able to put it into better words, you know, to say it, without it just sounding like old-fashioned crap and such. All right. So, I'll take a break because I don't. It's kind of a little dirt road. I like to get back to the highway if I can. All right. So a thought came to mind. So it would be sort of interesting that if every human being had to state a paragraph of text once a year, you know, so New Year's or whatever, some statement about what last year was about. What's the theme? You know, what did I learn? What's the big happening? What's the big event? And then if you could compile all those paragraphs, you know, billions of people all making a statement, okay? You know, a few sentences, a few declarations, That would be an interesting read, you know, that compiled, you know, take all the redundancies taken out and just see what it means something to people as they progress through their life. And I guess I would argue that, you know, in the ones in my teenage years would have been very interesting, because they'd be statements like, I'm an asshole. You know, that would be the statement. Oh yeah, I learned this year that I'm an asshole, that my brain is just percolating evil. I mean, it's, you know, not evil in some horrible way. I just mean evil in the sense that it's just such a jackass and a selfish fuck and a manipulator, and, you know, everything has a, you know, what's in it for me kind of bullshit. You know, it's just yuck. And then the next year I'll point out how, shit, I realized I was an asshole and I don't seem to be able to do anything about it. I'm still an asshole. You think I could have fixed that? I mean, you know, you recognize you have a problem. You think you could, you know, put some wart cream on it and make it go away. But it's not that easy to deconstruct it and find how it grows. You know, what's causing the asshole cancer, you know, and finding some mechanism to nip it at the bud, you know, get rid of it, so it don't grow back. Yeah, because, you know, but that's, then you know, the next paragraph would have been, shit, it's natural to be an asshole. I mean, that's how we're built. We're built not to be anything else. We're completely controlled by this subjective feeling shit, and there's not much you can do about it. It's really hard to recondition it. I mean, once you've gotten the conditioned response, you're sort of stuck with it. You know, your preferences in lots of areas, and food and chicks and all of this stuff, they're kind of fixed, and it's, you can't just say, oh, I wish I had a different preference, you know, and it goes away. It just ain't going to happen that way. It's going to take more work to work on the psychology, to break the psychology that compels you to find it interesting and intriguing and desirable and all of that crap. Addictions are, you know, a pain in the ass. And that's our nature is to become addicted, you know, to environments and people and stuff, pets, all kinds of stuff. And, yeah, it makes us, less intelligent. It makes us incapable of doing intelligence, because it just creates such a whitewash that even if you want to do intelligence, sometimes you can't even see through your bullshit, the bullshit of your own psychology. And, you know, it takes a great deal of straining for you to see, oh yeah, I can see the shadow of the truth there. You know, even though my subjective paint has, you know, painted over it, I can still see the outline of what really should be if I wasn't a selfish cunt. Yeah. And all of, you know, goes to so many subjects, and you can sort of see it in these subjects. I mean, I really shouldn't have to, you know, I don't think it should be an argument that people find objectionable to just point out things like, why would we think it's at all logical for us to think of our own genetic children as something better or superior or more in need of care than anyone else's children? That, you know, the property of being a kitten, should I really care what cat the kitten popped out of? How, you know, that's about the most unimportant detail, right? I mean, it's so tiny in terms of a detail that should matter to me. And that's just so logical to understand that the properties that make the thing valuable, it has the properties. It possesses the powers. And none of that context changes any of that. Who gave birth to it should matter to anyone. You did, so what? You know, why does that automatically change your perspective and make you devoted to this one, and, you know, sort of whatever happens happens to those other ones? It's just not logical. So again, everything changes in a way once you get rid of this subjective problem, because then there's no more of this cheating and pretending that, you know, yours are more valuable, because you don't have any evidence of that. There's no logic behind it. It's just your attachment. And the bigger question becomes, again, just this whole idea of you. Why does your life matter and their life is less important? Because if the brain was completely logical, then all it would care about is going out into the world and, you know, preventing headaches and preventing things that you find nasty and that you wouldn't want to happen to you. Well, you'd say, well, it's just as bad as if it happens to somebody else, so I should be conscientiously working to prevent all the things I know to be bad from happening to anyone, not just me. And I shouldn't spend 99% of my intellectual resources worrying about my welfare. I should be spending, you know, 1% on the world. It should be exactly the opposite. I should just get my due respect, and all of the other victims should be equally poorly fed and poorly treated and poorly, you know, I'm not a special victim. That's just impossible. I mean, I'm saying it's impossible. I'm saying I find it impossible. As much as I try, you know, I just can't do it. I can't manifest that kind of devotion to the principle, and ignore the immediacy of my own hunger and my own laziness and my own comfort. Can't do it. Haven't done it. But I'd say I've done better than I would have done if I didn't have this awareness that I am being a cheater, that I am paying more attention to me. My brain is paying more attention to my needs than your needs. just a fact. And I know it's a fact that shouldn't exist. And the only reason why it exists is because, yeah, I feel my feelings. I don't feel your feelings. But I know that feeling the feelings is the only thing that matters. It doesn't matter whose brain they're in. The unimportant dead people are really just as important as the important dead people. You know, their lives were just as real. If we were logical, we'd recognize that fact and learn from all of them, not the tiny percentage that we turned into poster childs for something. And whatever. Something like that, anyway. All right. One more break. All right. So, I was thinking of that little paragraph, you know, as you get older. And, life is serious business would be one of my paragraphs somewhere. I would think that would be one of the basic observations I have made. And it's not free, and it's not easy, and it's not the kind of thing you make the decision for somebody else, is sort of the, you know, obvious statement is how do you, with any kind of abandon, just say do it, go, because it's not free. It's, you know, it can have huge, it can go all kinds of wrong. And so with what justification would somebody impose it? You know, so that'd be another one of my words, you know, that sums up a statement about what the fuck's going on here. And it's just this reckless imposition, you know, from people who really haven't even thought about it. They haven't paid any dues to what it is to make all those victims, to keep all those people in those chains, so to speak. The ones who are going to pay the worst of it, who are going to get the worst of it. And not to appreciate that, okay, maybe you're saying you're willing, you know, you're willing to be buried in an earthquake and have to chew off your arm. You're willing to, you know, have these worst case scenarios, you know, get cancer 15 times or something and just spend 25 years almost dead, to be paralyzed, you know, and just able to move your eyeballs. Maybe all that stuff you're willing to do, but because you're willing to do it, you think you can impose it, you know, on somebody else. You don't think that somebody who would say, I'm not willing, that statement should be ignored and you should just walk right over it and say, well, you know, I'm going to negate your existence, negate your fear, your judgment, your opinion, because I have some justifiable certainty that I'm doing the right thing. I mean, not to have even pause, not to even acknowledge that people should be damn serious before they step into the let's make one. You know, what? That I should have to even, you know, we should have to even have an argument about how, yeah, this should be like something people consider hard and seriously, and don't spend all your time just saying how much fun it will be, you know, or how big a badge it will be you want to wear, you know, or how you can relive some unrequited part of your life. You didn't get to do a certain thing, so you're going to make sure your kid gets to do it, or some kind of bullshit like that. I mean, how much you're just using the kid to get to satisfy some problem you have. That all of that should never be a cause for somebody deciding to impose, you know. And if you got rid of just a percentage, I mean, you don't even have to get rid of 90% of the reckless bursts. You just get rid of 30, and again, we're already we've accomplished the task of negating the fact that, you know, the whole thing will just wind down and will gracefully go extinct, you know, which is, in my opinion, the reasonable conclusion to a bad story. It is just to end it. You don't perpetuate it. You don't continue it. You don't keep feeding the rabid dog. You just accept that it's not really viable. It's not a good enough condition. And the condition of existence, being conscious, is not nearly good enough, perfect enough, free enough, inexpensive enough to be justifiably imposed. Yeah, that sounds insane. So that's a horrid argument. You're not allowed to make that argument. You're not allowed to speculate on just how inefficient nature is and how grotesque, if you actually took account for all of the bad death that has taken place and recognized that what's for what? For these tiny little portions of glorious moments, you know, the splendor in the grass, the very few little times some organism on Earth breathes easy and comfortably. Tiny percentage. And the comfort is merely the elimination of the rain, the elimination of the negatives. How is that bad logic? How is that an evil construction? How is that, how are those words? How is, you know, that's more than a paragraph, but that basic statement that it's too serious to be casually or recklessly perpetrated. How is that evil? How is that something to be, run away? Don't face that argument. Just run away from that argument. Well, whatever. A message to the critics who aren't criticizing anything real. They're just trying to turn a philosophy that claims we should really be thoughtful before we do anything, because it all matters, because all the stories are important. How frightening. What a frightening commentary. Anyway, okay, so we'll call that a video and such. We'll get on with my tedious and moderately painful existence. Anyway, so till the next time and such and so forth and whatnot. Yeah, that's enough. This has been DoNotGod.com video presentation. Such.